Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last month, 4-methylcyclohexane methanol, a chemical used to process coal, spilled into the Elk River near Charleston, West Virginia. It turned out that little was known about the health hazards of the substance that contaminated the water supply for at least 300,000 people. In the wake of this disaster, we still don't know the full extent of what the long-term health impacts will be from the spill. This morning, we're going to talk with Deborah Davis, president and founder of Environmental Health Trust, about how the West Virginia emergency illustrates our inability to monitor and regulate pollution so that communities can be protected from toxic releases. Dr. Davis has authored a number of popular books, including When Smoke Ran Like Water. Deborah, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much for having me, Barbara.
And I think the last time we talked was back in 2002 when Smoke Ran Like Water came out.
Well, it's nice to talk to you again and like to do it more frequently.
Yes,
we have a lot of new things to discuss, including what's happened in West Virginia.
Well, let's start by talking about what's happened in West Virginia, and then we'll go back a little bit into your past life and why, what some of the events, the toxic release events that probably helped shape your career and your view of the world. But I've been following a number of environmental groups are talking about how we have what they're calling water sacrifice zones all across the country and probably throughout most of West Virginia. And it's a result of the fact that environmental regulations and enforcement are so lax. So let's talk about why is it that toxic spills like the one into the Elk River in West Virginia are so prevalent in this country and probably around the world.
Well, first of all, the reason we know about the spill that happened in the Elk River is because it smelled bad. And a lot of toxic chemicals have no smell whatsoever. So the idea that because it smelled so bad, people noticed it. It had a kind of licorice smell. Interestingly, this same chemical is approved for what are called room deodorizers or room fresheners. Now, in fact, there is no such thing as a room deodorizer. That's a marketing term. Many of the chemicals that are used in fragrances to spray in the air are basically toxic. And toxic meaning that at certain doses they can have a biological effect on something. This chemical spill left 300,000 people without water because it occurred in a leaking from a tank that was 1 mile upstream from the intake of water for Charleston, West Virginia. Now, if it had not smelled bad, it might not have been noticed for even longer. But in addition to that, children complained a few days before it was officially detected of burning and itching when they were taking showers with the water, which suggests that it actually occurred before it was officially announced on that Friday of January 10th.
Well, the Charleston Gazette reported that Freedom Industries, I love the name of that company.
Yeah, who has declared bankruptcy now.
Right, and that they not only did they not report that the spill was happening, but when environmental protection agents from the state agency came out to take a look because they were investigating the smell that people were reporting, initially the company denied that there was anything going on, and finally they were forced to go and show them this dike that was leaking. And at that point, they were able to detect that under the ice of the frozen Elk River, there was a huge spill happening. But it seems that they actually knew, first of all, about the problem, probably well in advance, that they were not doing very much to remediate it, and then that they actually hid the problem from enforcers. So what does that indicate about, well, there's two things. Part of it is maybe the mentality of environmental protection in West Virginia, but this seems to be a problem that we see across, industry-wide across the United States.
I think that we have missed the boat, and at this point, it's now some 40 years since the beginning of environmental consciousness in this country, and I think many of us have been lulled into a sense that we've taken care of all the big problems. And while it is true that we have cleaned up air pollution substantially, what has been missed from a lot of the public discussion is the following. One of the ways we've cleaned up air pollution is to increase water pollution. The particular chemical in this case, which has a long name I won't bother with, is used to prepare coal for burning so that it reduces the sulfur in the coal, which is a good thing. And this chemical was stored in a 400 in a tank which had a hole in it, and a stream came out from it into the river, leaving a pool of it that was detectable, again, because it was smelled bad and because it was winter. So that you got it under the ice, that you could, find it. What it says, as you indicated in your opening remarks, Barbara, is that we have failed as a nation to address the need for an integrated approach to toxic chemicals, that the toxic chemical Safety Act, which I was involved in, really should be called the Toxic Chemical Conversation Act, because we talk about toxic chemicals. We thought we had dealt with most of these big issues, and we frankly have not.
Well, one of the things that's most disturbing when you start looking at that act is that there are a huge number of chemicals that are actually exempt from the act. So why is that?
Well, in order to get the act passed in 1976, you know, politics is the art of compromise. And one of the compromise assumptions was that existing chemicals had a safety pass. You know, if they existed, they must be okay. Well, in fact, in 1983, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences issued a report on priority testing of toxic chemicals, which declared that full safety testing had been done on fewer than 1% of all chemicals in commerce, and some safety testing existed in only 10% of chemicals in commerce. That was 1983. I was at that time the director of the National Academy of Sciences Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology. Fast forward, and about every 10 years, the Academy issues the same report. And there's not been substantial progress in testing of toxic chemicals. Ironically, the government agency responsible for testing toxic chemicals, the National Toxicology Program, has seen a steady slash of its budget for testing toxic chemicals. And even though it's now led by the very able Dr. Linda Birnbaum, and they've been moving forward with what are called short-term tests versus long-term tests, which are less costly and give you results faster, that program is not able to provide the information that we all hoped when we secured its existence back in the 1980s.
So why is it that industry keeps creating new chemicals that are possibly toxic, possibly deadly, and that there's no way to, that they are being produced at a much greater rate than we can find out what their actual impacts might be on health and environment?
The presumption with which we approach toxic chemicals and, in fact, new technology, whether it's cell phones or other things, is that they are safe until proven guilty. They're treated like a criminal in a court of law, where it's understandable that we must have a high burden of proof before putting someone in jail for a crime. But in fact, toxic chemicals, and this is the entire approach that many of us are advocating now, need to be treated as though they have to prove safety before being released into the environment. And again, the same thing should be required of new technologies, whether it's nanotechnology or cell phones.
It seems like we have a different attitude here than in Europe, because in Europe, I understand they use the precautionary principle.
Well, on paper, they look very different. But the precautionary principle in Europe with the REACH program, which is re-regulation of an environmental assessment of chemical hazards, on theory, it does look like it's more precautionary. And there are some countries like Sweden, which has done wholesale things in their chemicals programs where they have reviewed and just cut out altogether some high-volume pesticides, which we continue to use in the United States. But the reality in Europe is not that different from the reality in the United States. On paper, they look like they're much better. But even the cosmetics reform, which has been going on for some time, theoretically, the European chemicals are better. But the reality is we haven't made much progress even globally. There is an awareness of the issue in Europe that is better. And some countries have done a little better, notably the Scandinavian countries, on toxic chemicals. But they're small countries, and they don't have a large agricultural base as we do. So the reality is we need to rethink our whole approach to environmental contamination, whether from toxic chemicals or technology.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how we could better detect chemicals, because as you mentioned, the chemical that spilled into the Elk River in West Virginia had a distinct odor. But what do we do about all those odorless chemicals that we don't know that they're harming us until people are actually harmed?
Well, we have in this country today a huge economic problem. We have underemployed people throughout the country. What I think we could have is a major job training program to train people in environmental monitoring and assessment. One of the problems that the Elk River contamination highlights is that we have no systematic inspection or monitoring for these things around the country. And monitoring is a rather boring thing. It means checking regularly to see for pollution. Even air pollution monitoring in the United States today, we have better air pollution monitoring in Mexico City right now than we do in most cities in the United States.
Well, it seems that this is like a recurring theme. I was in Richmond, California a year and a half ago when the Chevron refinery there caught fire. And it turned out it was uncovered within days of the fire, which sickened over 15,000 people, that there was a pipe that was leaking. They knew about the leak. They didn't bother to fix it because actually they were trying to do a major retrofit of the facility so that they could start to process tar sands bitumen there. And the community was up in arms and according to Chevron, was preventing them from modernizing the facility. So it was the community's fault because they didn't want Chevron to be processing bitumen. So this is the industry think about it. But it became more and more outrageous about just how much Chevron knew and how little they did, and that also their plant, that refinery, catches fire like every 3 or 4 years.
It's been a regular occurrence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was the second time I was in California when it happened, and I don't go down there all the time. So I thought this is really a strange coincidence that I've actually experienced this twice. And the fire 2 years ago was actually one of the worst ones that they had. But in West Virginia, there's a lot of talk about how there's lax regulation and the regulators, it's a revolving door between industry and regulators in West Virginia. But I wonder if it's that much worse in West Virginia than it is in the rest of the country, because Chevron is certainly getting away with I won't say murder, but they're getting away with like really egregious practices in California.
Well, as many people have reported in the media, West Virginia has a very bad history when it comes to these things. There was a major explosion in 2008 in the Kanawha Valley. And the Kanawha Valley is a chemically contaminated area. We've known that for a long time. And the response when the investigators came in to that was to say, you have to have inspection, you have to reduce, set up a whole new program. That response of recommendations that came from federal investigators was basically ignored. And so what they found out was this explosion came close to being a huge catastrophe, because there was a tank there that contained a chemical called methyl isocyanate, which blew up in Bhopal, India, and left perhaps 10 to 15,000 people homeless and thousands dead. The full toll has never been obtained because the Indians at the time did not have a good registry of who lived there. And that tank sat there with this explosion in West Virginia and came within 100 feet of being hit by a 2,000-ton vessel that flew into the air when this explosion happened. There were serious recommendations, and it was so bad that the U.S. Congress then held a hearing about what was wrong with what was going on in West Virginia. Well, the answer is nothing seems to have changed. And I think your program and the work that you do, Barbara, with trying to bring attention to these issues is really important. People have to understand they have a right to know what's going on, and that we all live downstream from the Elk River.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking this morning with Dr. Deborah Davis, who's the author of When Smoke Ran Like Water and several other books. And she's also the president and founder of Environmental Health Trust and has a long history of tracking and talking loudly and articulately about our many toxic problems here in the United States. And we're talking this morning about the lessons that should be learned from the contamination of the Elk River right near Charleston, West Virginia, at the beginning of last month. When I was looking at the list of what's being called the water sacrifice zones, I mean, they're all over the country, including in my home state of Massachusetts, which likes to pride itself with being such an environmentally and socially aware place. But actually, there's some very bad histories in Massachusetts, as well as a lot of the Northeast. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit historically about some of the issues that are the legacies of the industrialization, the very early industrialization of Northeastern United States, and how are those problems being addressed or not being addressed?
Well, as several environmental groups have recently pointed out, West Virginia is not alone. And there are sacrifice zones in Colorado, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania. And it may not it may make sense to actually have sacrifice zones rather than to try to clean them all up. And I say that because we don't have at hand right now the resources to deal with all of them. There are communities that haven't been able to, that have had to rely on bottled water for more than a year. The idea that and this is a kind of an appalling reflection of what's gone on in the United States.
What does that mean, actually? I mean, to designate a community as a sacrifice zone. This is a conversation I have with people that we're working with in Richmond, because Richmond is seen by a lot of people as, oh, it's a sacrifice zone, so who cares? There are like 150,000 people who live there, so how can you have people, how can you have a sacrifice zone where there's so many people that are living and being hazard?
I'm not an advocate of it. I'm trying to explain what it means is that you can't drink your tap water, and not only not drink it, but you can't use it for cooking, bathing, and showering. Let me explain. Half of your exposure to any toxic chemical that is in your water comes from cooking, bathing, or showering, because volatile organic compounds are released whenever you heat water. And so that's why, even if the water is not suitable for drinking, it's also not usually suitable for cooking, bathing, or showering. You can use it to flush your toilet. And there are communities now around the country that unfortunately are not able to use their water. And the concern is that with the spread of some environmental, some practices such as fracking in relatively densely populated communities, that unless guarantees are provided that the pipelines will not leak, and as you know, because you've reported on this, they often do, that action should not be permitted in those areas. So we know now that there are at least 10 major zones that have been identified, and many others around the nation. And one of the things that a number of groups have called on the president to do is to sign an executive order, creating areas of awareness and action plan to deal with these endangered water resources.
So what would that look like? That's actually, I received an email the other day about this particular collection of 60 organizations that were calling on Obama to sign this executive order. But what would it look like? What kind of impact could it actually have on changing the way that we deal with contaminating where we live?
Cleaning up the water is not a simple thing. And it involves filtration and double, sometimes with granular activated carbon, which then absorbs and adsorbs both the particulate matter and the pollutants that are in it. And the best solution to pollution is dilution. So that's why, as that plume of polluted water moved down the Elk River, it became less and less of a threat to communities further down the area. But what it would mean to address these sacrifice zones would be to set up major water decontamination processes, and these are not easy to do. That's simply the case. The best way to deal with this problem is to prevent it in the first place. Once it happens, you'll spend much, much more to try to deal with what's in the water than you would have spent if you tried to prevent it in the first place. But that having said that, we're dealing with injection wells that are now being set up to handle the extra waste generated from energy extraction with fracking waste injection procedures that you've talked about. And this push toward this new extraction industry has created a major public health threat, both in terms of the air pollution generated by some of the huge diesel vehicles that transport materials back and forth, as well as the threat to groundwater in many areas.
So before we move to prevention, which seems to be what we should really be looking at, I want to talk a bit more about what happens to these areas that are being designated as sacrifice zones. Would there be plans or some ability to actually somehow clean them up and return them to a place where people could once again use their own tap water?
Well, we have a series of laws in this country that are very difficult to implement dealing with this, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act and the so-called Superfund Act. They can require, as a matter of law, that anyone that has polluted this water with injection chemicals or other things be required to set up a cleanup well. That can be done. The process of doing that often takes years and lots and lots of time of overworked and underfunded public officials in the state attorney general's office or the city attorney generals, who are often charged with this. Sometimes the EPA gets involved. But Superfund enforcement is a very long-term issue. So I'm afraid I can't give you a simple answer to your question. The technology that exists to clean up polluted water is generally costly. And what happens in these sacrifice zones is that people are told don't drink or use the tap water, and bottled water is often trucked into them. But the number of sacrifice zones is extensive, and they're not all related to the fossil fuel industry. Some of them are related, as in the case of Elk River contamination, to processes that were designed to clean up the coal so that when it's burned, it doesn't burn as toxic a residue. And some of them come from the thousands of abandoned coal mines in which there are wastes, some of which have been pumped into those wastes without securing their leaking. And so we've got a huge problem. It may well be that there are small communities that would be, it would be a suitable thing for the government to pay to move people rather than to clean up the water. That's a terrible thing to say, but it's the truth. The truth is, it's sometimes a much more effective thing to do to protect public health, because the capacity to clean up the environment does not yet meet our capacity to pollute it.
Well, you started out by talking about how there's no such thing as a deodorizer. And I was thinking that it's kind of a metaphor here, because we create, I mean, these deodorizers you're describing that we're creating that are toxic to begin with are also being used to cover up other problems. And I wonder if you can sort of talk a little bit about how that is an example, perhaps, of a larger problem, that our whole concept of deodorizing our problems.
You know, that's an excellent thought. Deodorizers and room fresheners are sold with the idea that fresh smell is good for you. Many of the fresh smells that come from these deodorizers, particularly the ones in public bathrooms and the like, use highly toxic chemicals. In fact, the chemical that contaminated the Elk River is an approved deodorizer. It's approved. That's one of its uses. So the notion that you can disguise the smell of methane that comes out of a bathroom, which is what is made by humans and anybody else that defecates, with a chemical has, you know, taken deep root in our society, and there are people who think, you know, we love the commercials, they love that smell. Usually the smell has relied on toxic chemicals. Even if the chemical is a natural product, such as terpenes that come from pine, or D-limonene that comes from citrus, there will be some people who are highly sensitive to these chemicals, even though they're naturally based. You can, as a practical matter, if you want to deodorize your bathroom, you can take an orange, stick cloves in it, and it will naturally emit some smells that most people find pleasant. There's no such thing as a non-toxic chemical, whether it's natural or not. And I think that that's something that's a little hard for people to get their mind around. A lot of the chemicals that we use in pharmaceuticals or for these natural deodorizers, such as those based on citrus products or pine cones, can be toxic to some people. And so we want to think about reducing our use of even those things, but especially the ones that have that sort of pink perfumey fragrance that, frankly, I gag at, and I think increasing numbers of people find objectionable. Those ones we definitely want to try to reduce our use of, but the fact that we try to cover over smells with something else is, I think, a metaphor for how we deal with a lot of issues in our society today.
Well, it seems like it would be better to put in a ceiling fan, or you know, a exhaust fan.
As I said, the solution to pollution is dilution, and a ceiling fan increasing your air exchange rate is one way to deal with these. And we also have to re-educate ourselves culturally about what smells we're willing to accept.
Actually, I was reminded by many years ago, we had a house sitter who left the cast iron pan on the stove while she was going out with somebody, came home and it was in flames, and the house was full of smoke. So what she did, besides buying us a new cast iron pan, was to spray the house with a deodorizer. And I would have much rather to come home to the smell of smoke, because yeah. Then we had to deodorize the deodorizing. But I think that there's a mentality in this country that you're kind of addressing, that we aren't looking at the root problems, the cause of problems, that we are trying to just kind of cover things up with and creating new problems.
Unfortunately, that's often the case. But as I mentioned before, just in terms of dealing with these problems, I mean, the Superfund program was passed in the 1980s, thinking that it would be the solution to the huge number of sites in the country that had been abandoned with toxic chemicals in them, and now we realize that many of the solutions that we developed, like Superfund, like the Toxic Substances Control Act, have proved inadequate to the task. And I think part of the problem is we need a national conversation about the role of government and the role of industry in acknowledging that there are serious problems here that do need to be addressed. That the ideas that we had in 1980 when the Superfund law passed seem awfully simplistic nowadays. And in 2010, there were just a few, like 1,200 or more sites on the list that needed high priority. And in fact, since the law was passed in 1980, which is some time ago now, they've cleaned up fewer than 500 sites and taken them off the list. And that's a sign of how hard it is to do this, and frankly, it's been a boom to the legal industry, because lawyers on all sides are involved in what happens in this situation. And I mentioned Superfund as an example of something from the legacy of when we thought we knew the solution to environmental problems involved a lot of law. And I would say that environmental law set the stage and reflected a national consciousness that we needed to do something. But we have to rethink our approach there, because what it did is it gave vent to a whole group of attorneys and on all sides, but did it really result in a major protection on an improvement in our environment? I think in the area of air pollution, it certainly succeeded. Today, the average air in the United States is cleaner than it has been, and the pollutants we have to worry about are often indoors rather than outdoors. But with respect to water pollution, which we're talking about here today, sometimes the solution to air pollution created more water pollution.
Well, this morning we're talking with Dr. Deborah Davis, who's president and founder of Environmental Health Trust, and we're talking about the lessons that can be learned from the massive spill of very toxic chemical into the Elk River in Wyoming a little less than a month ago, in West Virginia. Wyoming is where Deborah lives, actually, right?
Right.
And you have your issues in Wyoming, which maybe on another show we can talk about. But I want to talk about one of the other concerns that has been raised is how little is known about this chemical that contaminated the Elk River. And that also the question of were there other chemicals besides the one with a very long name that nobody had ever heard of before? It was in newspapers across the country.
I'm sorry, Barbara.
So the two questions are, it turns out that there's very, very little known about the substance that spilled into the Elk River. And also questions about what other possible contaminants might have been part of this spill.
Well, first of all, it was stored, this particular chemical was used to clean coal, to prepare it for burning, and to reduce the amount of sulfur and other contaminants it released. It's never had full toxicology testing, so there's missing information. We don't have reason to think from its structure that it's going to be as highly toxic as other things, all right? And there are a number of chemicals like that. They're just out there. They're grandfathered in because they've been around for a while. I'm not sure that I can answer your question about how do we know whether there are other things like there out this? Because the reality is we have over 80,000 chemicals in commerce today. They are not tested well, and many of them are used for things like this without our very good information about what toxicity they may have. The usual standard for testing toxic chemicals was, does it kill someone in the sight of the investigator? And if it didn't kill you immediately, it was assumed to be safe. Well, we know that's ridiculous. There are a lot of chemicals, lead is one of them, formaldehyde is another, where there's no real reaction necessarily right away, and it's the long-term cumulative exposure that we must be much more concerned about. And that's where we have failed. Now, in testing toxic chemicals, it's not a simple thing. I don't mean to imply that it is. We used to, the standard was a two-year animal bioassay, taking rodents, taking about 50 animals of and now of each sex, and exposing them to the lowest dose, to the highest dose the animal could tolerate without dying, and then lower doses. And then studying those animals for 2 years to see which of them died and which of them died of cancers, etc. That approach to testing showed results that were pretty interesting. What we found was that every chemical that we knew caused cancer in humans also produces it in animals when adequately tested. That was a pretty powerful finding, because that would suggest that when it comes to toxic chemicals, if you can show something in an animal, you better pay attention to it in a human. Now, the reality is that some chemicals, that testing program of 2 years, proved to be very onerous, extremely expensive. Now there are short-term tests, tests of the capacity of a chemical to affect genes, for example, the capacity of a chemical to affect DNA repair, or certain measures of genetic damage that can indicate and predict cancer. And these short-term tests have now been validated as a battery that can be used, along with examining the structure of a chemical and its potential activity. So we know from the structure of the chemical that contaminated the Elk River, it does not look as highly toxic, for example, as some of the dioxins or benzene.
So I wanted to spend the last few minutes of our interview talking about a childhood experience. Actually, I think you were an infant when it happened, but the infamous smog in Denora, Pennsylvania, and how that has affected your outlook on life since then.
Well, I grew up in a town that in October of 1948 had a very unusual thing happen that really set the stage for environmental consciousness in the United States. The town of Denora, Pennsylvania, is nestled in the Monongahela Valley, about 30 years and away from Pittsburgh. And it was the consummate company town. It included steel mills, coke ovens, and a zinc plant. And people heated their homes with coal. In that town, in that five-day period of October near Halloween of 1948, an inversion of air hit the town, with the valley having fumes from burning as much coal in that small town then in 1948 as the entire large city of Pittsburgh then burned, including its steel mills. And after 5 days, when this pollution set on the town without any relief, 20 people had dropped dead. My own grandmother had a heart attack, one of 25 that she would have before she died. And after the pollution ended, when the rains came, at first they said it had been an act of God that had led to this horrible disaster. It was never adequately studied, and in fact the first investigators that came into Denora to look into the problem were run out of town by people with handguns. But eventually a study was done, and although I tried and tried over many years to find it, the records appear to have burned in a mysterious fire. So it's a classic example of how difficult it is when a town depends for its livelihood on a polluting source for any information about that pollution to be obtained. And it was only when I went away from the town of Denora with my family that left after the mill shut down that I discovered there was anything unusual about Denora. Because growing up there, I just assumed it was normal not to see the sun for days at a time. And I came home from school and I said to my mother once, "Mom, was there another town with the same name as ours?" She said, "Why are you asking?" I said, "Well, I read in a book at school. There was a town called Donora, and it was polluted. Is there another Donora, like in Mexico or something? Because it sounds vaguely Spanish." And she got kind of quiet, and she said, "Well, you remember how the sun didn't shine for days at a time?" I said, "Yeah." "How we used to clean the walls down with a special putty once a year after the winter ended. And we could drive with our headlights on during the daytime." And I said, "Yeah, of course, I remember those things as a child." She said, "Well, I guess today they would call that pollution. But back then, it was just a living."
Well, do you have a sense of things changing between 1948 in Donora and 2014 in Charlestown, West Virginia?
They have changed in that the obvious big sources of pollution have been addressed when we can see and smell them. They have changed in that we have much better laws in place, and all major corporations have an environmental sustainability unit, and they're all trying to be more responsible. The large corporations are. But the reality is we have a legacy of pollution from old practices, old coal mines, and some of the things we're doing now to improve our ability to treat coal that leave us with a very unfortunate set of problems for which there are not simple solutions. And rather than point fingers in all directions, I think we have to be a little bit like that old cartoon character Pogo. We've met the enemy, and it is us. We are responsible now to recognize the scope and scale of this pollution, and we need to have more of a national conversation about how to deal with it. In my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, I recommend that we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Toxic Hazards. Now, I know this is an idealistic notion, but that's okay. I'm a writer. I can be idealistic. The concept is based, of course, on what happened in South Africa and in Chile and Argentina, where after periods of horrible oppression and murder, the countries realized that they had to have a truth and reconciliation process where people came forward and were given amnesty for confessing what they knew. And as a result, they were able to heal. And I think that for toxic hazards, what we need is a similar thing. We need a truth and reconciliation commission where companies come forward with information that they have about toxic chemicals or environmental contamination or workplace contamination. And in return for giving us that information, they're given amnesty from criminal penalties and agree to pay to clean up any problems they've created. A similar thing could be done with the cell phone industry now, because the cell phone industry is aware.
Actually, I'm going to have to cut you off because we were just about running out of time. But
okay.
I want to talk to you again soon about the cell phone industry.
All right.
I would like to continue this conversation maybe in a couple months. And
I'd be happy to do that. The book on cell phones is called Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phones, and you can get it on Amazon.
Great. Well, thanks a whole lot. It's been really good talking with you, Deborah.
Nice talking to you, Barbara. Bye-bye.
And we've been talking with Dr. Deborah Davis, President and Founder of Environmental Health Trust, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm. Next week, we'll be in Pledge Drive and have a special guest, Mackenzie Funk, author of Windfall, look at the winners and losers of climate change. Before I check off, I want to let you know that there's a very important gathering happening tonight at 6 o'clock at the Federal Building, downtown Portland, northwest corner of Southwest 3rd and Madison at Chapman Square. It's the XL Pipeline Response and Call to Action. Keystone XL Pipeline has been approved by the State Department in its final Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. Now it's up to Obama to actually give it the go-ahead or to do what he said he would do. And if, in fact, it appears or is obvious that the pipeline will have a great impact on climate chaos, that it would not be approved. So people are gathering all around the country tonight to call on Obama to do what he said he would do. and to leave a true environmental legacy. So that's again at Chapman Square, across from the Federal Building, downtown Portland, Southwest 3rd and Madison at 6 o'clock this evening. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Sting. Thanks for listening.
On Thursday, February 6th, Africa Oyé will help kick off our winter membership drive with a live broadcast from Mississippi Records. Dr. Zahm will return to hosting the first show of each month and will be joined by special guest DJs spinning the tracks. Mississippi Records is located at the corner of North Albina and Sumner and will start up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So, tune in from 2 to 4, February 6th, and don't forget to support your local source for the finest in freeform radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th Annual Portland International Film Festival. This festival is the largest film event in Oregon, featuring over 100 international shorts and feature films. The films will be shown at a variety of Portland theaters from February 6th through the 22nd. More information about these films, dates, and locations can be found at kboo.fm and click on the right side of the page under Community Events.
And it is a minute past 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and stay tuned for Health Watch. And Health Watch is followed by Madness Radio today. So it's another great morning on KBOO. If you're not a member of KBOO, make sure to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Jonathan Baylor, is a former personal trainer, the host of a popular syndicated health radio show, an expert in nutrition and exercise, and the author of the New York Times best-selling book, which he's here today to discuss, The Calorie Myth, How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. Welcome to Health Watch, Jonathan Baylor.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a pleasure.
So I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there today who hear the subtitle of your book, Eat More, Exercise Less, and Lose Weight, and go, yeah, right. This is just another gimmick. This is impossible. So before your book goes in, a lot into dispelling what you consider the flawed rationale of the calorie model. But before we go into that, can you just introduce us to the history a little bit around where the calorie model came from and what its assertions are?
We started moving away from food and started moving towards a lowest common denominator called a calorie. In right around the 1970s, when the government started getting involved in our diet and when they started telling us to eat less and exercise more, and ironically, at the very start of the obesity diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and heart disease epidemics. And the idea was if we could just have one simple measure that equivalence classed all food and all physical activity, for that matter, that it would simplify things and that we would all be healthier and fitter as a result. And it is a simplification, but it's a simplification a bit like saying the sum of any two numbers is 43. It's simple, but it's patently wrong. Not all foods are the same, and they cannot be dumbed down with one single metric. And by doing so, we've ended up in the horrible mess we are today with all the disease and obesity that we are today, simply because it is a proven incorrect model.
Can you share some of the... You take some of these assumptions to their logical conclusions in the calorie myth. For instance, if we cut a certain amount of food or calories out of our diet, or looking at how much more calories we eat over decades as a population, we should see a certain amount of weight gain that we don't see. Can you share some of those with our listeners?
One of my favorite studies on this subject came from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And what they did is a deep analysis of our actual caloric consumption. And what they found is that in 2006, the average American was consuming about 570 more calories per person per day than we were when we were relatively weight stable as a country in the 1970s. And the conclusion of that paper was, see, we're just eating too much. But